Are you building a high-growth business in tech, healthcare, AI, media entertainment, or consumer goods and services? If so, we'd like to help you scale. Apply for a chance to win capital, coaching, and access to an amazing community of diverse innovators. Applications for the 4th annual Black Ambition Prize competition are now open. Don't miss your chance to win $1 million. Apply today at blackambitionprize.com.
I find that most white investors are not giving black founders that same kind of grace. We have a boot camp where we teach founders how to protect themselves in these situations. Unfortunately, one of the worst parts of my job is I probably take 8 and 12 calls a year, every year, from a founder who has been inappropriately removed.
I feel like I have to take a deep breath on that. It's a story that I think not a lot of people are very candid about how often it actually happens, especially to black founders.
So many investors believe in the goal of Lightship Capital.
The black-owned VC firm is headed by investing power couple Candace Matthews-Brookine and Brian Brookine, who both have one goal in mind, to invest in the next wave of innovative entrepreneurs who have been overlooked by other investors.
It goes kind of untalked about. The problem is the negative people, they're counting on your silence. I was very public. That's kind of where my spicy Twitter came from. I was like, look at these
I would love to dig into the media company because I think that's an absolute game changer. This larger second fund that you've created, some lots of zeros.
Let me just talk directly to the camera and say.
All right, Brian. So you are a general partner at Lightship Capital, a husband, a mentor, someone who does spicy tweets.
Oh, I love a good spicy tweet.
Spicy tweets. Yes. And an avid Eagles fan, right?
Yes.
Tell us a little bit more about like you, right? I also know that you're a PK kid from Philly. Tell me a little bit about the Philly story to being the general partner of Lightship Capital.
You know, my Philly story actually starts in Ohio. I was born in Ohio, in Cleveland. My father was a Nigerian transfer student. Mother was African-American from Ohio. Had a baby too early. Mm-hmm. Then I had Amish foster parents for the first year and a half of my life. So no technology, candles, the whole nine. Then I was adopted by my parents, African-American couple in Philly. Mm-hmm. And so for me, Philly's like a blessing. You know, it's like my parents mean the world to me. My mom was a psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. My father's an engineer. So you know a little something about this, right?
Yeah.
My dad gave me like the rigor, kind of like the structure, right? And my mom gave me like the soft skills.
Yeah.
So I can look at you and be normal and like engage because my mom, right?
Okay.
And I can code, right? Because of my dad, you know, engineers aren't known for their soft skills, as you're well aware. Yeah.
Nice. So tell me how, okay. So really unique, interesting perspectives from a background, family upbringing standpoint in Philly. Mm. And how do you go from Philly to Apple and IBM?
Well, my grandfather, as you mentioned, is a Baptist minister. Big kind of mega church, kind of 7,000 member, you know, sort of thing. So I learned a lot about service.
Mm-hmm.
And that's played a role throughout my entire career. He's a classic, you know, freedom rider style, you know, bus boycott,
yeah.
You know, kind of guy. And so I've kind of taken a little bit of that energy and kind of put it throughout my work. I get to Apple and California is the most liberal conservative place in the world,
right?
I mean, you have like people saying, I voted for Obama, but also like, oh, I'm not going to fund that black thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like both things are true about the place. So I never experienced that before moving there. And I learned a lot about the power of technology and the power of what we were doing at Apple, but how that power and that capability wasn't equally spread amongst the population. And so then, after leaving Apple and starting up my company, Kairos, we moved it to Miami, which to me had the best of all worlds, right? The diversity that I was looking for, but also the opportunity that you had in California.
Yeah. Nice. And so why Miami for you, right? Because you've lived in a lot of other places, but for whatever reason, there are lots of reasons you always come back to Miami.
Mm.
What's special about
like
Miami
a bad
for
marriage,
you?
Boy. Just keep going back. No. I love it. I've moved to Miami twice in my life.
Mm-hmm.
Once for the right reason, once for the wrong reason.
Mm-hmm.
I actually moved to Miami before I moved to San Francisco for about a year. I broke up with a girl in Philly, and I was like, what am I doing here in this cold and snow? Like, you know, I'm not dealing with this anymore. And moved to Miami, moved to South Beach on Ocean Drive, 14th and Ocean. I mean, the most cliche version
I'm
of Miami.
It, yeah.
So embarrassing. And that's when I got the call to work at Apple. Went there. The second time, though, it was a really thoughtful exercise. Mm-hmm. I created a rubric and was looking at what place had the most engineers in our tech stack. At the time, we were a PHP shop. It's very common mm-hmm. in Latin America, so we have a lot of PHP engineers here. What had the lowest business tax, the lowest personal tax? And most importantly, what place had the most angel investors to startup ratio? So in California, there are 3 startups for every 1 angel investor. Yeah. And in Miami at the time, there were 3 angel investors for every 1 startup. Mm-hmm. And Black founders raised from angel investors at nearly the same rate as their white counterparts yeah. because it's a committee of 1, right? If I meet you and you think it's okay, you feel some connection, you see something in me, you will invest your money. Mm-hmm. But in a venture fund, when there's sometimes 6 partners, 8 partners, 12 partners, all of them have to have unanimous votes.
Yeah.
And for some reason, there's always 1 person that just can't get quite comfortable with the woman's deal or the African-American's deal, right? So we don't do as well in those groups with that bias. And so if you're looking for funding, you should always go where the largest number of angel investors is. And people get rich, they move to Florida, mm-hmm. then they're bored. They join these investment clubs like almost as like way to buy their next set of friends.
Yeah.
And that's how we raised almost $13 million.
Nice. How did you navigate those rooms in the early days, right? Because I feel like startup events in the early days in Miami startup ecosystem, there was like you, Derek and I would be there. I think Tennyson, who's in the audience, would be there.
Yeah.
But navigating those rooms were extremely difficult, right? Especially if you didn't come from a specific background that kind of helped you learn how to navigate that. What was your process around that, or were you stumbling and just kind of figuring it out along the way?
Definitely stumbling, but number 1, fifth grade English. Mm-hmm. That's what I have now. Fifth grade Spanish was mm-hmm. actually huge. If you could show people that you're at least trying, you get a little, like some brownie points, mm-hmm. right? I think that showing them that you see them and that you mm-hmm. understand who they are, that helped a lot. Number 2, going to events is more important than you think. Sometimes mm-hmm. you're at home and you're on your laptop and you're like, I don't have time to be socializing. But I remember my very, very, very first tech event, and the very first person I met in all Miami Tech mm-hmm. was Austin Bunsen. Mm-hmm. Guy's a co-founder of a unicorn now, right, in Miami. And he was like, I guess he saw me kind of like sheepishly walking around. I was like, hey, who are you? What are you working on? And he started to introduce me to the second person, which is Wilfredo Fernandez, who started the Lab Miami, mm-hmm. who took a liking to me because I folded my pizza before I ate it. And he went to
eat. It sounds like Wilfredo.
Right? Like, yeah. That's all he needs. Uh-huh. Yeah. And he's like, where are you from? Why do you fold your pizza like that? Oh, I'm from Philly. Oh, I went to Penn. Like, and then kind of went from there. So, okay. Yeah, it's amazing.
Okay. And so just don't stay home with your head down, just building the thing. Like, yes. Fully implant yourself into the environment, into the events.
Don't stay home. Be humble. Mm-hmm. Definitely listen to, first, reach out to investors asking for feedback.
Yeah.
Then they're going to invest in your company after they realize you're really interesting. And so okay. I did a lot of that as well.
Talk to us just briefly about Kairos, right? Because it was, I think, at that time where we met. But tell us a little bit about why you started it and its significance to the work that we do, the lives that we live today.
Yeah, I first had the idea while I was still at Apple in California. I wanted to do actually a time clock company mm-hmm. unrelated to facial recognition. And I did. We built one. It was beautiful, very Apple-y, mm-hmm. right? And then we got a call one day from a customer. It was an oil company in Texas. And they said, hey, love the product, but we have to get rid of it because people keep cheating the system. They're putting in each other's numbers when they're late, right? Something called buddy punching.
Yeah.
And we need to verify.
I did that my first job.
No, you don't know anything about that.
I got fired from Wendy's.
You got caught?
I was 14. I was just like, I'm running late. Can you put my... So
yeah, you got caught. Uh-huh. So yeah, millions and millions are lost every year to that, you know, behavior. So we started using the new front-facing camera on the phone to identify who someone was. And it was really hard to make it work on mobile, all these things. And we realized like oh, like making facial recognition work for corporations or on mobile or any modality. Like that's the real big idea. So we just stopped doing the time clock and started doing facial recognition. The company just took off, and its company still exists. It processes almost 1 billion human faces a year now.
Mm-hmm. You had an interesting roller coaster running that company, starting that company, like most people, right? Like it's the ebb and the flow.
Oh, yes.
But I think there were some very unique ebb and flows with you running that company. Can you share a little bit more about, like, how do you, looking back, how do you best structure a board? Mm-hmm. How do you best kind of fortify yourself as a founder mm-hmm. when you're bringing on investors, when you're structuring your board, when you're trying to scale very quickly?
You know, my situation, unfortunately for Black founders, isn't unique. Mm-hmm. I was removed by my board in 2018, inappropriately. A little history there. I had raised the $13 million, got the company from a $0 valuation to $120 million valuation. Yeah. And what happens is, we have a lot of the angel investors we talked about, is they're not participating as the company grows. They still own a very, very small amount of this very, very big thing. All CEOs report to boards and all boards report to shareholders. Mm-hmm. And so after asking me to let them buy more and get more ownership a number of times, and I didn't see why we would do that or what the value there was, mm-hmm. They removed me and then tried to kind of like lock me out of the company. So I sued, won, took the money from that winnings and started a venture fund ultimately. But what's really most important is Black founders in particular, but all founders need to be thoughtful about their docs, mm-hmm. how people are removed, their name being on their document. So like Brian Brecky has a board seat for his whole natural life. Like if you're starting something, you should be on that board as long as you want to be on that board. Mm-hmm. And now as an investor, when I see organizational documents for like white male founders, they always have all the protections. Mm-hmm. And when I see women and minority founders, they're always trying to meet the investors halfway.
Right.
Right. And that's really, really, really difficult place to start because in the end, they're just extracting from you.
Mm-hmm. But what, so the day that you were removed from your board, like how did you feel? What was that conversation?
I remember very well.
Yeah, yeah.
I think I might have even seen you that day. You didn't even know.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So there's a really, really great Black professional network here called BPN. Mm-hmm. They have this annual event, really well attended. And I was giving a talk to Black students at that event. Mm-hmm. And during the event, my laptop shut off. And I was like, oh, that's weird. But I'll wing it. They won't know. Uh-huh. They're kids. And so I got off stage. I had a voicemail from my former chairman, who was then, by the way, fired by the board, saying, hey, so sorry to leave a voicemail, but we're going to end your contract as CEO today. We're going to do the best we can for your equity. I appreciate your service to the company.
Via voicemail.
Via voicemail. I wouldn't let go like anyone via voicemail, yeah. Right? And so I thought to myself in that moment, like, oh, okay, like, I'm going to have to go to war on this. And then right as I was thinking about that, another sister we both know, she was like, oh, it's so good to see you. I'm about to get some lunch at this, what's the Jamaican place in not too far from Little Haiti?
Clives.
She's like,
or is it Cliffs? Cliffs and Clives.
They're going to take your car.
Clives is here. Cliffs is North Miami. Yeah.
Clives. And so she's like, do you want to go to Clives and get some lunch? I was like, sure. And I just literally put it out of my mind. I had the most amazing jerk chicken mac and cheese. It was amazing.
It does solve a lot of problems in life, though.
It does.
That and Ray and Duffy, but that's another story.
Listen, Jamaican don't solve all problems. Uh-huh. And so after that, finished, said my goodbyes, kind of rolled my sleeves up, and then went on to about a year and a half of litigation. Mm-hmm. But I knew that I was going to prevail, and ultimately did.
Mm-hmm. That's like, I feel like I have to take a deep breath on that, yeah. Right? Because it's a story that I think not a lot of people are very candid about, mm-hmm. about how often it actually happens, especially mm-hmm. to Black founders. Mm-hmm. And then more than anything, like how do they legally prepare for that to potentially happen? Mm-hmm. Which was advice I got from Tara Priestley. I don't know if you know her, but Between her and her mom, they owned at one point the majority of the stores and concessions that you saw in the South Florida airports, all three. Mm-hmm. Her mom started it as like the first black contractor to get it when she was based in Belgrade. Neither here nor there. But I remember like when we were getting, Derek and I were getting, bringing on our investors for Feverish, like that was her advice. She was like, make sure that your contracts and everything are prepared in a way that like litigation is inevitable. Mm-hmm. She's like, you never want to end up there, mm-hmm. but you want to make sure that it, like Felicia, it more than likely will happen.
Yes.
And so like, how does that then now inform your conversations, your term sheets, your deals that you have with entrepreneurs that you're investing in? Are you more so erring on the side of caution and mentoring them through that process? Or it's kind of like you really just kind of wear the investor hat and just like, you better come prepared.
Yeah, I mentor, and I find that most black investors take a mentorship approach to investment. Mm-hmm. And I find that most white investors are not giving black founders that same kind of grace.
Yeah.
We have a boot camp where we teach founders how to protect themselves in mm-hmm. these situations. And unfortunately, one of the worst parts of my job is I probably take between 8 and 12 calls a year, every year, from a founder who has been inappropriately removed, asking me for my help because of what happened to me. Mm-hmm. And I always take the call. I wish it was one a year. I wish it was zero a year. But it still happens.
Yeah. Yeah. Aside from what you guys are doing with, is that bootcamp Numi or is that a different?
Yeah, we bought a bootcamp called Numi. We rebranded it called Lightship Bootcamp.
Okay. So, yeah. But aside from what you do with Lightship Bootcamp in order to kind of prepare them, are there any other resources, any other tips that you can share with founders in order to kind of prepare themselves for that journey?
Mm. No. The answer is
other
no.
Than life.
Yeah, like. Yeah. I mean, it's an underreported thing. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, founders that it happens to, they don't want to have this conversation.
Yeah.
Not on the best podcast in the world, so I'm surprised, hey, right?
Y'all heard that here, right? Y'all heard it here.
That's going to be the sizzle reel, I know. But so it goes kind of untalked about. Mm-hmm. The problem is the negative people, they're counting on your silence,
yeah.
right? They're counting on you not saying anything. I was very public. That's kind of where my spicy Twitter came mm-hmm. from. I was like, look at these motherfuckers, you know, that kind of thing, if you can say that. And I think that ultimately served me.
Yeah.
Because I had obviously lived a life where something seemed wrong, mm-hmm. and then people came up, reached out to help.
Yeah. Is there a way that we take the shame out of that or not so much? Because I feel like, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, like our most black founders will not want to talk about it because of fear that one, just like disappointment period, right? Two, that they'll be seen as failures and they'll never be able to raise additional funding or launch another startup. And then on the other side of that, it's just like, I blew through all this money as irresponsible as possible. Give me more. Like there is that is often talked
100%,
about, right?
100%.
So is there a reframe for black entrepreneurs around that by being more transparent about the process? Because sure, it helps other founders, but on that other side for like the next raise or the next company, do you see them being able to, if they're more transparent about what has happened and transpired, that it helps or hurts them moving forward?
I think in the grand scheme, it helps mm-hmm. because if someone still believes in you, then you know that they're really for you.
Yeah.
Right. But it does, I'll also say it does hurt in that people who are not really doing the work or even the right research, whatever, are going to just dismiss you
yeah.
because of some Google search or whatever. That will also be true. But ultimately, I sleep better at night knowing that I stuck up for myself. Mm-hmm. And anybody who has so little character as to, you know, not dig deeper, I don't want that person as a partner anyway. Yeah.
Did your family always understand the journey that you've been on as an entrepreneur?
I would say that, and he's since passed, but my grandfather mm-hmm. was an entrepreneur, as well as my great-grandfather. So we have some of that in the DNA. Mm-hmm. My parents are very much not. Mm-hmm. Worked at, you know, corporations, met at a corporation.
Yeah.
You know, like, though my parents always said, like, you know, whatever you do, whether it works out or not, you can always come back here. Mm-hmm. You know, that kind of thing. Like, I don't know if this Kairos thing is, but yeah. you know, we'll see. Now they finally got over it. Now, like, oh, okay, I see he can like mm-hmm. feed himself.
Yeah. Was that reassuring, right? Because I think when we talk about sharing stories or like rock bottom moments or understanding like when you, there's like there's different levels of failure for people, yes. right? It sounds like your bottom out was like you could always come back home and maybe sleep in your childhood bed.
Yes.
That was kind of same for me, right? My mom was just like, come back home to this your pink room, right? But that was also like rock bottom failure. For other people, it's sleeping in the car or like even worse, right? Was that helpful to you to always know that like it wasn't ideal, but it was kind of a soft landing?
Yeah.
Did that allow you to take more risk than most people would be able to? Because I think there's always like a nuanced conversation when people are just like fail fast, because for some people it's absolutely detrimental. Yes. For others, it's like, I got to go back to my parents' house. I definitely don't ever want to do that. But like it allows you to navigate different. Can you speak on that a little bit more?
There's a lot of privilege in being able to have a safety net.
Yeah.
Right. And quite frankly, not everyone has a safety net. Mm-hmm. Right. And so they can't even take that approach. One of the problems in venture and startups in general is that it's highly designed for the young white male founder.
Yeah.
And we're all told, like, pick up your all yourself, young man, and move to San Francisco and live in a van and like work at Google for a little while. Then it'll all be fine, yeah. right? Well, some people have kids and right. some people have family and some people are from wherever, right? Mm-hmm. Particularly, we think about like the families here in Miami and like West Indian culture and our responsibility to our ancestors that other groups don't have in like other parts of the country. And so just moving and using that kind of dogmatic approach doesn't work for the rest mm-hmm. of us.
Yeah. So we met, I don't know the exact day that we met.
I don't think so either.
But I remember the very first day we started Code Fever, which wasn't even like a thing. It was just like a one day pizza, laptops, and like our employees come and we'll teach you how to code. And you said yes. Like you were one of the panelists. McKeever yep. said yes as well. Yep. I think Denise Jacobs. There was like a few OGs, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And just poured into the kids yeah. that day. And I think yeah. that was the first time. And then Wilfredo brought it all together and lended us our space. Like those were like the early days where people were just happy to be together, right? like, you know, you don't have to be in the gym shooting it by yourself or whatever, however the sayings go. And so we met then. And then Black Tech Week, which you and Candace acquired 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like there's a little bit of a love story that was a part of that. Can you share how the two of you met?
First, as I turn it back on you, we acquired it from you and Derek, like so graciously. Now, keep in mind, guys, this is like the worst possible way to buy a company. I had never asked her why she started it. Why would I buy something? I don't even know what am I thinking? So
we were literally right before this. He was like, I never asked you that.
I literally don't know.
Yeah. The quick is Derek is the one who actually started it. Mm-hmm. I think I just kind of became the face. Sorry, maybe I took it back. But we started it because we had started Code Fever and we were training young people how to code. We were getting our friends to just kind of come in and help kids at a time where no one cared about young Black kids, African-American and Caribbean here in South Florida learning how, just nobody cared. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I always tell the story, it's funny because like people now will literally recite things to me that I said 8 years ago when I was trying to get them on board and they just looked at me like I had three breasts. Like, what are you talking about? And so we started Black Tech Week because we didn't want to be a train and pray organization. Mm. Like we were training young people and then we were praying that there was an actual opportunity for them and we couldn't ensure that at all and just felt really uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And so we started Black Tech Week as a way to like, we're going to bring all these people to Miami so they know how cool Miami is. Mm. But then just like 1 week of the year, we could promise that like, you know, maybe your next investor will be here or your co-founder or you'll learn something really cool about technology or like whatever it is. We could just 1 week of the year, we can guarantee that collision point can potentially happen. Mm-hmm. And that's why it started. The other part of that, not to like knock on the ancestors, Black History Month just became very downtrodden. And it was also very problematic for me. Mm-hmm. Right. I was like, we rightfully so only celebrated our ancestors, but like there was the parade, there was like the MLK breakfast, and that was kind of it, right? And so if you wanted to do something future-facing or celebrate or be able to find opportunities, as far as it related to Miami, there wasn't like a lot of options. And like those were the two big reasons. So finding, attracting more opportunities and then being able to provide some elevated programming during Black History Month in Miami. So those were the two big reasons for starting.
Wow. So it's still true today, right? Mm-hmm. Almost all those things. So I guess in year six or so, the conference got bigger and bigger, mm-hmm. and it was known, it went from kind of being like a regional thing to more of a national thing.
Yeah.
And there was a group from Cincinnati, Ohio. It was paid for by actually a very wealthy ex-City White founder, where he sent like 12 Black founders and a couple of his own partners down to Black Tech Week from Cincinnati. One of those folks was Candace.
Mm-hmm.
And she was married at the time, interestingly enough.
She'd
married
for, no, just kidding.
Yeah, you know, exactly. Spicy for the podcast. And so she was married 19 years before we got married. And so she came down. I was on stage. Mm-hmm. And I gave a talk about Kairos. And she thought to herself, oh, like, that guy there, he's got a real company, right? And that was, and she, now her version is that I didn't say anything. I ignored her. Not true. Yeah. Not true. But that's her version. The following year, she's divorced. Mm-hmm. A mutual friend said, hey, did you hear Candace was divorced? I said, Candace is divorced? Say less. And so we were standing in the lobby of the Center for Black Innovation. And she'd just become an investor. Mm-hmm. Everyone was pitching her, right? Because people think that when you're an investor, you like literally have the millions of dollars in your pocket.
In your pocket, yeah.
Like you're just going to hand it to them right that moment. And she was an early like pre-seed investor, and we were much later stage. Mm-hmm. So I was like no threat. And I said to her, hey, like, at first I said to her, to someone else, this is one of the smartest women I know, right? Because I really did respect her.
Yeah.
And number two, I said, hey, do you want to get out of here, stop getting pitched so much, and I'll just like show you Miami, give you a little Miami tour? Like the Brian Miami tour is very famous.
It is. It's a good one.
Yeah. And so we went around. She said, heck yeah. We went around town, did a little Soho House, shared a cookie and a burger. Mm-hmm. And we were engaged 6 weeks later.
I literally remember the connection at the center, because I was looking. I think I was looking for you to tell you that there was lunch, and I like looked out the door and y'all two had like walked to the right. I was like, oh, that's interesting. But that was kind of it, you know? And then 6 months later, I was like, oh, I think I remember the moment. And so that's so phenomenal, because I think there's, I mean, you know this, you're married, but like there's so many amazing attributes about the both of you coming together in the way that you have. Mm-hmm. And everything that you have built since then, right?
Yeah, 6 years of greatness.
Six years of, you say greatness?
Yeah, on her side, yeah.
Yeah, both sides, both sides. But Candace, you know, she get a little inch higher. And so talk to us a little bit more, right? And so you've had some really big announcements lately, right? And I would love to dig into the media company, because I think that's an absolute game changer.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to dive a little bit more deeper into this larger second fund that you've created that I've heard like lots of zeros behind
lots
that.
Of zeros.
So talk to us a little bit about why Black Tech Week, right? But then more than anything, why Black Tech Weekly, and then also the fund?
Let me just talk directly to the camera and say, don't ever buy something from Derek or Felicia, because they're going to get out right at the right time. It's going to be all encompassing, and you're going to work 70-hour weeks. They do. I don't, you know, I've taken that on, that burden. So that's for the people. Don't do it. But no, it's been a blessing.
Yeah.
You know, we are forever in both of your debts.
Mm-hmm.
And it really has become, you know, our adopted life's work, you know, from your amazing stewardship.
Yeah.
And so what happens is, when you start to get people together, right? It was 1,200 the first year we bought it. It was 3,000 people last year. Next year, we expect it to be about 5,000 to 10,000 people. You start to see their needs and what's missing in the ecosystem. You can see the whole ecosystem in front of you, right? Mm-hmm. And then what do builders want to do? Yeah. We want to fix it. We want to fill those needs. We want to fill those gaps. And so you know, the first thing we did was have a $50 million venture fund directly investing in women and minority founders, except for in Tulsa, where we exclusively invest in Black founders to rebuild Black Wall Street. We realized that these founders, their stories weren't being told. So we started a media company called Black Tech Weekly. Really exciting. We did a deal with CNBC, NBC, Apple News, Inc., Fast Company, others, to be essentially the tech-associated press for Black founders.
Which is huge.
Yeah. We tell them, this person's interesting. Their reporters go out, write a story about them. Then they send it back to us for final edit. So we have full editorial control to make sure the stories are told the right way. And then we syndicate those stories across all of them and Black publications. Nice. It's sponsored, our prime sponsor is Procter & Gamble, which did a multi-million dollar deal. And what we do is we actually pay the white media organizations less and we give the Black ones extra money.
What are you doing now?
Yeah, you know, for equity. So we're really excited about that piece of the work. Yeah.
Nice, nice. That's huge, right? And I think one kind of coming off of the last 3 years where there's this push to diversify a number of things, but especially newsrooms, right? Mm-hmm. And I think even in that, the stories were a little contrite, like just not like, it wasn't the full breadth, right? Mm-hmm. And or what I kept seeing was that they could not just tell the founder's story or the industry expertise or the disruption that they were making without prefacing it in the negative or the deficit first,
yes,
right?
Yes.
I was like, if I hear this less than 2% quote before every story, like I don't know what I want to do, but it's just frustrating. Like, how do you just tell the story, right? And so I think the way that you guys have structured that just allows for the full breadth of the story, and then like this social capital that those entrepreneurs need in order to be able to get additional access, opportunities, resources, eyeballs, and essentially dollars. And so phenomenal hats off to that. Talk to us about the fund now.
Yeah, so we're starting our fund too. Oftentimes, a $50 million fund one would be followed up by a $75 or $100 million fund two. Mm-hmm. You kind of expand your existing work.
I don't ever expect you to do small jumps like that. No. I've known you too long.
Exponential, right? But there was a bigger hole. We realized that Black founders weren't getting a fair shot because there are not enough Black investors.
Yeah.
And when there are Black investors, they're even not capitalized well enough to kind of really, really go deep. You know, we've too many Black investors writing $250,000 checks and not writing $25 million checks, that kind of thing. And so how do we solve, you know, for that? And so recently, we launched what we call the Anchor Fund. It's a $2 billion venture fund focused on Black fund managers, where we make anchor investments. So we'll invest $20, $25 million into each manager, creating hundreds of new Black VCs globally. So as long as you're Black and you're on Earth, that's who we're investing in.
Nice. I love it. What's next? What's current? What's next for you, Brian?
That's not enough.
I mean, it's a lot. It's a lot. But
I'm so tired.
I mean, you guys are launching in new cities.
Yes.
Like, there's always like this next big thing of a problem that you're solving because you're like a builder at your core, right? And so, is there anything else that you'd want to share with the audience?
A number of things. One, Cincinnati has been a wonderful home for Black Tech Week. We thought it's the right thing to kind of put it out to other cities and see what came back. And so Cincinnati is applying to keep it, but also we're seeing strong interest from places like Philadelphia, Baltimore, Birmingham, Alabama. Places like that. So really excited to see kind of where it ends up. And we're really expecting to have a 10,000 person conference, you know, next year.
Yeah. I love it. I love it. Brian, thank you so much for the work that you do, your dedication to this mission. And thank you so much for sharing some of your ambitious moments with us at the podcast.
Thanks for partnering.
Thank you.
All right. Bye.
Heineken is proud to support Black Ambition in helping to unlock opportunities for its participating founders.